Okay, so moving right along here. Announcements here. So now that you're starting with Lab 5, these are the labs that you're going to get into Arena. And so because of that, the lab exercises will actually refer to exercises that are based on things out of that Arena textbook. I've actually provided old versions of the textbook or links to them that I think should be sufficient. The downside is I'll mention throughout the semester is that the newer version of Arena has a slightly different interface. And so if you use the old version of the text, it'll say something like, to look here to find these elements when they're actually in a slightly different place. But once you've made that transition or that translation, it's pretty easy to the exercises are identical. Just have to figure out that things that used to be here are now over here. So hopefully you'll have easy access to that, but you will need access to a copy of that textbook, that Kelton et al. Textbook. Pretty much any edition after the fifth edition, as long as you're okay with the version differences with Arena 16.1 and up, which is the version that you'll find on the lab computers. If you download the version, you'll find that. And it's just good to stick. I mean, there are old ways to get old versions, but the downsides of the old versions is if you save a model with a new version, you can't open it in an old version. So that creates problems when you collaborate on your final group project. So it's good that for everybody to just use the newest version, but that means that the easy to access texts are going to have images that won't quite match what you see in the software. So just heads up for that. So I've got information on how to get access to Arena on Canvas. So you go to the Arena downloading and finding helpful examples under the Arena Help module. It's right near the top of the modules. Then you can find a bunch of information about Arena. And of course, you've also got that remote access. So in the left-hand side of Canvas, there's this Aporto, Aporto, Aporto link that connects to a remote server that already has Arena installed, and you can access that and run it through the browser. They've been working on trying to make it, so in times of high demand, it can get a little laggy, but they've been trying to make that better. And I think it has gotten better from semester to semester. So hopefully that's not a terrible experience. So, paying attention to installation instructions on Canvas. There are template panels, which you're going to learn what those are in the labs. That, again, the book will reference older template panels, which where were these blocks that you pulled in, whereas the newer version has put them in newer template panels. For sort of future proofing, it's good to just learn the new panels. But if you want to make things look like the book examples, then there's information here, as well as I think in Lab 5, I mentioned information on how to load the old panels in so you can just find things where the old panels were. But the new panels are kind of good looking forward, but to make things easiest now, then if you want to load in the old panels, then there's information about that. So that's just info about as you start working with Arena. Otherwise, schedule stuff. Homework C2 is due Saturdays. Remember, homeworks are due on Saturdays. That ends up helping me make sure that we get solution sets out with enough time before the midterm. Homework D2 is available and it's due next Saturday. And those are the last two homeworks before the midterm. So they're meant to be practice for the midterm as well. So homework D2 is related to random variate generation. You will get that solution set before the midterm, but in all cases, for all homeworks, whenever a solution set is released, I can't take any more in. So make sure you get those submitted by that Saturday or really Sunday at 10 a.m. is that grace period. After E1 disappears, ICAF will be released. It is a much longer Canvas activity than normal, but you can take it as many times as you want. And the reason it's longer is because it's sampling from all the previous ICAs. And so this is meant to help be a midterm practice exercise. So that's why it looks so different. So it is, more points. So if you feel like you got everything down, then maybe it's not worth the time, but you can take it, over and over again. And so, if you start taking it and you realize that, I've got this, and then you get a low score, then it'll be one of your drops anyway. So, but then if you decide you want to go back and keep trying it as you're practicing for the midterm, then gradually your score will increase. So it's very different than all the other ICAs. So just keep that in mind. Midterm is coming up soon. As a reminder, it's a two-stage exam. So basically the week before fall break, I will be here Tuesday and Thursday of that week. You don't have to be, but I'll be here in case someone wants to use this space at that time to bring a laptop in to take the Canvas-based exam. So it will be released definitely all day Tuesday and all day Thursday. And I probably will release stage one Monday and Tuesday and stage two Thursday and Friday. So they'll have even extra availability. I'm still deciding on which stage goes on Wednesday. But the idea is when it's open, it'll at least be open stage one all day Tuesday and stage two all day Thursday. Then stage one is the only timed one. So for stage one, that all day Tuesday, you can start at any time, but then you got 90 minutes to finish it. So you come to this class. There is a class that comes in after this one. So if you do want to take it here, then you're going to be limited to that 75 minutes. But if you take it anywhere else, then I give you that extra 15 minutes just as for technical issues, because it is run through lockdown. And then stage two is not run through lockdown. Stage two, you can collaborate with anyone else that is currently enrolled in this class. And that means you can come here. So a lot of times I'll show up here for stage one and there'll be no one in this class and I'll wait around for about 15 minutes. If nobody shows up, I just leave. And that's fine. Then when I come for stage two, what I'll get is a subset of the class. Like I'll get a handful of people just collaborating over here, just audibly collaborating, talking to each other. And then usually a kind of, a couple of other people kind of peppered throughout here. They may sometimes interact, they may just sort of listen in. But then most of the rest of the class is elsewhere. And that's totally fine. That's just a kind of a normal dynamic that we see. So it's kind of up to you. You don't have to work collaboratively on stage two. It is an option. It will be the exact same exam as stage one, but you don't get your answers. You don't get your scores. You do get scrap paper in stage one. And so you're free after stage one to write down the problems that you want to make sure that you revisit in stage two. And your total score will be 80% stage one and 20% stage two, just weighted and added together. That's how that all works. That is, again, the week before fall break. So it's coming up here in a couple of weeks. It's over these first couple of units. So I think the units up through E. And we'll have a midterm review lecture F. That will be the day, like that'll be like the so stage one will be on a Tuesday. That lecture F will be on the Thursday, the week before that. And that'll just be greatest hits of all the slides. So the slides that I think kind of capture the salient points of all of the previous lectures, then those will be there. But if you have questions, we just work on those questions. But they're just meant to be there to help generate questions if people don't have come with questions. Yeah, and that's basically it. So any questions about the schedule moving forward? All this is on Canvas. It's on the Canvas calendar. You can also get your questions answered there. But just a reminders here. Okay. Then of course the arena competition entries at the end of this month. So, you've seen that a bunch at this point. All right. So, last time we introduced probability measures, probability spaces. We mentioned we have to worry about probability because we, in this class, we build stochastic models. Stochastic models use randomness to make modeling easier. We do not say the world is random. The world isn't random. The world just has a lot of degrees of freedom that we have a hard time keeping track of. So because it's easier to have fewer variables than more, then rather than trying to keep track of every single thing that could cause a variation in nature, we create random probability distributions. We use them, which have very few parameters, in order to generate realistic variation without a great deal of modeling burden. So that's the idea. That's what a stochastic model is. It's a guess or a conjecture that the underlying source is random, even if we have a lot of evidence that it isn't random. So that's what we mean by stochastic. Input modeling is the process of choosing those probabilistic models that we use as stand-ins for variation in the real world. And so we in the today are going to start talking about some of the Lego blocks that we use to build our input models. So that's kind of the setup there. So in order for us to understand those probability distributions, we have to understand probability. And so we talked about that, a probability space is a mapping from a sample space, which is a set of outcomes. A random variable, that is a mapping from a set of outcomes, a sample space, to the real line. Once we've made that numerical mapping, once we've assigned numbers to outcomes, we can then build mathematical constructs which represent the frequency of those outcomes. And that's what a probability measure is. And we import a lot of intuition from mass. So just like we have a conservation of mass in the natural world, we have a conservation of probability in probability spaces. And so that's why we see a lot of the same terms. So for example, the mean is also known as the center of mass of a probability distribution. So, we talked about we have discrete random variables have probability mass functions, which we depict this way with these little delta measures that place an infinitesimal place mass at an infinitesimal point. So if this down here is the teeter-totter on the playground, and these are six kids, then these are sort of, maybe this is a short, somebody who's kind of a younger kid, and this is an older kid. So different heights, different masses, but they're all sitting on this same teeter-totter. So this one's lightweight, this one's heavyweight, and but they're only sitting at those individual points, and we assume that everything in between them is negligible. So that's how we look at this. And so we can estimate that the mean of this thing is probably somewhere over here, because in order to balance out these heavyweights with these lightweights, you'd have to put the lightweights farther away and you put the heavyweights closer, and that's where we get the mean is probably around here. So that's the idea of when we look at these probability mass functions. So when you're plotting PMFs, don't connect the dots. It's fine if they're just a scatter plot. If they're just dots, you don't have to draw these vertical lines going down, but don't connect the dots, because once you draw a line, a horizontal line, if for a probability density function or mass function, you're implying that outcomes occur there. But in a discrete random variable, it's only these six outcomes. So that's what we mean by a probability mass function. Any questions about that? Okay, and then we have continuous random variables as well, where at that point, the mass is actually an integral under a density function. So we have this probability density function, which represents how probability mass changes as you add more kind of linear, as you add more chunks of outcomes, then the density function tells you how the area will change. So there is no mass at a particular point in a density function, just like if you cut an infinitesimal slice of this tabletop. If it's infinitesimal, it doesn't matter how dense the tabletop is, it'll have zero weight, zero mass. But if you create, cut a chunk out of this tabletop, it will have weight, it will have mass. And so that's the idea here. And so density function is not probability, it can be greater than one, is kind of a key thing there. So otherwise, it has a lot of the same features of probability, but it's sort of like the derivative of probability. So you integrate under density to get probability. So these are its properties. Again, the big thing is not a probability, it can be greater than one. So examples of that, these are probability density functions. So this is a uniform random variable that is distributed between 0 and 0.5. So it only has outcomes, but it has outcomes anywhere between 0 and 0.5. They're continuous outcomes. But the area under the curve has to be 1. So in order for the area under the curve to be 1, the density has to go up to 2. So the density can be greater than 1. That means that as you add more outcomes, if you asked what's the probability of going from 0 to 0.1, and then if you expand that to say what's the probability then not from going to 0 to 0.1, but from 0 to 0.15, then the density function tells you how that new probability is going to increase relative to the old probability. So that's why the density function could go to infinity. It's a density, it's not a probability. And so that's why it can be greater than one. So, and you can see a better example of that here. Here's an exponential random variable whose mean is 0.1. So the area underneath this curve is zero, but it falls off very quickly. So it has very few outcomes out here. So to compensate for that, the probability, because you need the area underneath it to be equal one, the density is going to end up having to shoot up to be very high. So this density goes to 10. That doesn't mean the probability is equal to 10. That just means that you add the probability very quickly for these low numbers. But as you increase, as you bring more outcomes into your event that you're weighing, then gradually they add less and less weight. So that's what the exponential is communicating there. So any questions there about density functions? What is being depicted? Okay. Then the thing that brings them all together, the thing that we love to use, is the cumulative distribution function, or CDS. So a CDS is the probability of an outcome that is anything from negative infinity on our measure space all the way up to whatever the argument of the CDF is. And so it's taking that huge chunk. So you go out from negative infinity all the way to here, and then that huge chunk, we're measuring the probability of when would, you know, would that outcome occur. And so for a discrete random variable, it's just summing up every outcome that is less than or equal to that argument, and for summing up the probability of that outcome. And then for a continuous random variable, it's taking the integral from negative infinity up to that point of the density function. But then once you get there, then we can forget there's no discrete CDF or continuous CDF. We don't have to treat them differently. Once you have a CDF, then you can treat them basically the same. And so there's a lot of nice features of CDFs. So you've learned to use histograms. We're going to learn that actually looking at a sample distribution as a CDF, not as a histogram, has a lot of benefits over looking at it as a histogram. But you just have to get used to looking at CDFs when you've so gotten used to so far as looking at histograms. So we'll see more of that after the midterm. But a lot of good, nice properties of CDFs to remember. CDFs always start on the left at zero. They always end on the right at one. Whenever you go from a lower outcome to a higher outcome, the CDF has got to be non-decreasing. And if you're, I ask you for the probability of an interval, how much does an interval weigh? And I give you the CDF, then you just take the CDF of the upper side of the interval minus the CDF of the lower side of the interval. So, and then there you go. And so these properties work regardless of whether it's a discrete random variable or a continuous random variable. It's the magic of CDFs. Any questions about a CDF there? They allow us to do a lot of things computationally as well. Okay, so we've seen this already in some of the examples. So this was an example of service times. And so we were saying that in a queuing system, you might have a service time of 3, 6, or 10. And so the 6 happens 45% of the time, and then the rest is split between the 3 and the 10. So you go up to a server, and this is sort of, you know, is this going to take long, short, or really long? And that's kind of the distribution here. So this is what your stakeholders give you based on their data. But it turns out that in order to generate that random variable inside the computer, it's much more convenient to list that as a CDF. And that's what we have here. So looking toward the midterm, you should be able to look at a PDF and be very comfortable turning that into the CDF. So hopefully we all see that here, that the first entry is just a copy of what's in the PMF. And then the second entry, we add this entry from the PMF to the existing accumulative probability. And that, you know, so 0.3 plus 0.45 gives me 0.75. Then this 0.75 plus 0.25 gives me the one. So it always ends at one, and it's implied that it's zero out here for any values less than three. So any questions there? You see how we go from PMF to CDF just by adding things? And then once we have that CDF, so this is the interpretation here, is that 3 minute service times occur with 30% probability. That's this one here. If I switch to the CDF, then what we're saying is that 3 minute service times or less happen with 30% probability. 6 minute service times or less happen with 75% probability. And 10 minute service times or less, that's everything that occurs with 100% probability. So that's how we interpret that. And then if we have that, then it makes it very easy to draw random variables because we can plot the CDF. So because it's discrete, it looks like a stair step. That's a property of it being discrete. That's not a special CDF. All CDFs are equal. It doesn't matter continuous or discrete, but when you look at the CDF, you can tell it's discrete because it's got these jumps in it. And when I look at that, I plot that. If I draw a random number between 0 and 1, if I put that in the y-axis, so I'm inverting the CDF, that's something we're going to learn. It's called the quantile function, the inverse CDF. If I invert that CDF and I put in an input here in the y-axis, then it ends up telling me an outcome. So I have uniformly distributed, random numbers that are anything, then equal density from 0 to 1. But when I go here, then I'm going to get outcomes 3, 6, and 10 that match my desired biased density. So this is how we generate biased outcomes, is by using an inverse CDF, which is one of the reasons why we care so much about CDFs. Questions about that? We're going to learn a lot more about this inverse transform method in lecture E2. Okay. Likewise, we can do the same thing with continuous CDFs. So it again rises from 0 to 1, asymptotically to 1. So it just rounds off here at an asymptote. And so we can do the same game where if I draw a random number between 0 and 1 and I put it in the output, so I invert the CDF. So I take the y-axis as the input and the x-axis as the output. Then I get an outcome, and those outcomes, even though these outcomes are uniformly distributed, they're unbiased. There's an equal probability of getting outcomes anywhere along this interval. The outcomes along here will be biased, so you'll more often get outcomes closer to 0 than far from 0. And that's due to this bend that occurs in the CDF. So you can see here, these are equally spaced. And even though these are equally spaced, here, these two points up top are spaced farther apart down here. These two points are spaced closer together. So you can see that equally spaced points down here on the bottom, from say 0 to 0.5, they will clump together close to 0 on the output, whereas points from 0.5 to 1 will get spread out. And that's the magic of the inverse CDF, allows us that even though Excel doesn't know how to generate exponential random variables, Excel does know how to generate random numbers. And with this transform, we can turn the random numbers from Excel into any random variate we want. And we'll learn more about that in lecture E2. But questions about the CDF or this general idea? Just sort of start remembering this idea as we start using it more and more. Okay. And then expected values, means. So the mean is an important moment where it is going to be, if for a discrete random variable, you just take the value times its probability and you sum all those up. For a continuous random variable, you take the value times its density and you integrate underneath those. That's called a moment when you do that. And so this particular moment is the center of mass of a distribution. So if you imagine this thing is a wood block that's been shaved in this shape, then this would be where that wood block balances. And that's the mean. And so we can do the same. This is with a continuous distribution, but we can also do this with that teeter-totter example. So if we have a discrete random variable, then again, the mean gives you the balance point. If you imagine each one of these are children on a teeter-totter, that is where they would balance and sit perfectly horizontal if these were sort of the sizes of those children that you lined up there and got them to stay. Questions about mean? Should be review. An interesting thing about this is if you add outcomes at the mean, it doesn't change the mean. So this is one of the reasons why physicists will often replace an object by its center of mass. Because if I figure out that, if I grab that chair over there and I want to throw it across the room, and I just want to figure out where it lands. Now we know that chair is going to tumble and do all these sorts of things. And what it's doing while it's tumbling, that might be interesting. But if I'm just interested in where it lands, then I may not care about all of those things. And I just want something to replace that chair. And so the physicists say, well, if I can collapse that chair into a ball, like a tennis ball, where would that tennis ball need to be on that chair so that it would follow the same trajectory as the chair? And that's the center of mass. So it's the ability to replace interesting variation by a single point for simplicity. That's the reason why we use the mean in statistics. Is this idea that there is variation, but if I just need a ballpark, just trying to understand roughly where things are going to be, then I can replace this distribution with its mean. Because if I were to clump a bunch of outcomes on top of that mean, the mean is invariant, it doesn't change. And so if I gradually add more and more outcomes here so that they wash out all of the variation so that most of the things happen at the mean, then I end up getting a distribution that's very predictable, but it has the same mean behavior. So that's the reason why we use the mean, that allows us to replace probability distributions with points when we need that simplicity. Okay. And then, but there are other moments. These are, they're called nth moments, and you use the same formula, but you raise the outcome value to the n, where n is your nth moment. And the most important one that we worry about in this class is a so-called second central moment. So it's a central moment because we take the original random variable and we subtract off its mean, creating a new random variable. And then we ask that new random variable, what is your second moment? And so that's where we get second central moment. A central moment is a moment taken after you've subtracted off the mean, and the second central moment is taking that formula with n equal to 2. And fortunately, you don't have to do that ugly integration, because if you know the second moment non-central moment, this is the normal second moment, then you take the second moment minus the square of the mean, and that will give you the variance. So the variance, again, that's a fancy another name for the second central moment. And this helps characterize spread. So mean helps, mean is the thing that if you replace the distribution with one thing and it tells you roughly where that distribution is, that's the mean. Variance says, okay, I didn't want to get rid of all of those details, so I want to summarize the spread. So mean is position, variance is spread. So it's a way to get rid of the details of the distribution, but leave a little bit of information in there about variability is variance. All right, so that's our review. Questions about that before we move into probabilistic models? Okay, so the idea is with those foundations, then I think I actually have, yeah, a clicker. So where we're going to go for this is with those foundations, now we're going to say, what are the probability distributions that are very useful to us as we're building models in industry and other application spaces that people might ask us for help with? But before we get there, let's do a clicker and also get some practice here. So I'm going to start a multiple choice. Right here. Let's do that again. Okay, so I should have, I think the clicker is up and running. Oh, it's almost up and running. All right, now it's up and running. Okay, so question here. Let's look at these three. We're going to do a couple of different clickers. So the first question here is, which one of these is a PDF? So I'll give you 10 seconds to clock your answer in. Then I'm going to go and ask you a new question about these three. So which one of these is a PDF, a probability density function, A, B, or C? So just take a guess And I will hit stop here in about 10 seconds. All right, 5 seconds. We're going to do this for PDF, CDF, and inverse CDF, or neither, sorry. We're going to do these for for PDF, CDF. We're going to do it just for PDF and CDF. So clock in your PDF, and then we're going to do a CDF. So which one of these is a PDF, A, B, or C? Go ahead, clock in your answer. 2 seconds, one, and stop. All right, now one, I'm going to reopen it. And now when I reopen it, clock in which one of these do you think is a CDF? CDF. So go ahead, it's open. A, B, or C, which one is a CDF? So take a few more seconds. Remember, these are graded for coherence. As long as you have A, B, or C, you're going to get credit for it. If you answer D, then I'll know that you weren't here and you or from remote and you're clocking in answers. So as long as you A, B, or C, you're going to get credit for this one. CDF, which one is the CDF? All right, I think we had 53 people last time. We only have 50 now. So last three of you, get in your answer. Which one of these is a CDF? I'll give you three, two, one. All right. Okay. So, all right. So I've got your answers logged. Now let's see. So if we think about, let's do CDF first. So, by a show of now an informal poll, quick show of hands, how many people say this is a CDF? How many people say this is a CDF? Okay. A few hands, how many people show this is a CDF? Right, a few more hands, and then there's some that were, but it sounds like the majority were kind of going here. Why would this be a CDF? Does somebody have an explanation? Thoughts? Yep. It's the idea that it's non-decreasing. That is a property of a CDF, that it's non-decreasing. It is rising. But this one is also rising. So what are other properties of this one that might make it likely to be a CDF? Yep. What do you mean by that? 0 to 1, right. And those are two of the key things I'd want you to look for. Is in a CDF, it's non-decreasing from 0 to 1. That's a CDF. Often are S-shaped, not always. This one is a CDF for an exponential. It doesn't have that inflection point, but so it just rises straight up here, but it goes from 0 to 1. So, and it doesn't decrease anywhere. So yeah, this is definitely a CDF. So then the problem with this one is if you look at its y-axis, it goes from 0 to 100. CDFs are probabilities. And because they are probabilities, they have to be bounded by one. So a CDF can't go above one. So this one can't be a CDF. Okay. So this was what I would call CDF. So then what's the PDF? So how many people say then, where it's between these two, how many people would say this is a PDF? How many people would say this is a PDF? All right, it seems like there's more people clustering around that one. I feel like this is like the Monty Hall problem, like now that I've shown you what's behind this door or something. But so between these two, why do we have more confidence here? What makes this a PDF? Or what makes this one not a PDF? Can we even tell? I'm gonna say this is kind of a hard one. I know that this one is the PDF. I know that the area underneath this curve is equal to one, but the area underneath this curve might be equal to one. So there's nothing immediately that discounts this one. If I kind of do a ballpark estimation, like if I look at this and I say, well, this is one on the x-axis and 100 on the y-axis, the area of the whole box is 100. So this looks like a significant fraction of that box. So it's probably more than one. So that would be a reason why I'd say this is probably not a PDF. Whereas here, I look at this goes up to 0.1 and 100. So the whole area of this box is 10. And this, I could say, yeah, maybe that's a tenth of the area. So that makes it me think that this is more likely to be a PDF because it looks like the area underneath there is one. But otherwise, it looks pretty good. Both of them look pretty good in that they are greater than zero or greater than or equal to zero everywhere. And that's kind of the key feature. So if I, you know, once I know that they're greater than or equal to zero everywhere, they're not negative, then I have to ask what's the area underneath them. And this one, I think, is much more plausibly has an area of equal to one. And I know that this is an exponential and this is its CDF. This, does anybody, can you tell what this is? It's the inverse CDF of this. So if you take this thing, if you put a diagonal line down here and then fold it across the diagonal, you get that. So this is your random variate generator of an exponential. This function here tells you that if you had a random number uniformly distributed between zero and one, this function tells you what the outcomes will be if you want to generate an exponential. Okay, let's do another one, but let's I'm not going to worry about a clicker for this one. Similar idea though. So now I got four options. So let's look at these and let's say, I'll start with the CDF first. So how many people think that D is a CDF? How about C? How about B? How about A? All right, some more hands for A. So again, the nice thing about A is that it is non-decreasing, it's always rising. It starts at zero, it ends at one. One of the potentially confusing things is on the x-axis, you see that it goes below zero. But that's okay. That's just saying this random variable takes negative values. And that's fine. Random variables will sometimes take negative values, sometimes take positive values. There's no constraint on the values, the outcomes of that random variable, the outcome space, the sample space. But there's constraints on the probability. And this one is, it looks much more like the CDF. All right, so then, all right, so we've figured out where the CDF is. What about the PDF? So how many people would say, I'll go the same order. How many people think D is a PDF, a probability density function? How about C? How about B? Okay, very few hands. Let's try that. I'm gonna do so B, raising hands for Bs again. How about C? A few more hands. How about D? Okay, so a little less confidence on this one. You know, if we look at, remember, a probability density function, what is a key thing that excludes something from being a probability density function? If you see it, you know it can't be a probability density function. You can see it fast. Negativity. So this one's, the y-axis here has negative values. So this one can't be a probability density function. So we immediately exclude it because the densities have to be non-negative. So it could be this one or this one. This one isn't even a function because, you know, if you have for the input, you have multiple outputs. So this one here is a graphical inverse of this one, I think. But it's just because I flip the graph, it's not a function. And a probability density function has to be a function. So I can't have two outputs for the one input. So it's definitely like this one. So this is our PDF, most likely. Now, in order for me to be sure about it, I have to take the integral underneath this curve and see if that integral is equal to one. If I roughly eyeball this, I say, well, that whole area of the rectangle is three. I buy that that's about a third of the area of this graph. And so, yeah, maybe I buy it. It's definitely not greater than one. So I would say this is our most likely PDF from these. It can be greater than one. PDFs can be greater than one. So that doesn't exclude it. So it fits. Question. The for a for a PDF, the density will always be on the y-axis. For a CDF, the probability will always be on the y-axis. So both of those functions, their inputs are outcomes and their outputs. So the x-axis for a CDF and the x-axis for a PDF are come from the sample space. They're well, I would say they are the real projections from the sample space. They're the things that could happen. And then the y-axis are the probability-related metrics that describe the frequency of those things. So yes, but when we, so this PDF, its integral is this CDF. So this is how you go from here to here. And you can see this CDF does have an inflection point. It is S-shaped, as most CDFs are. And the inflection point is typically the mode of the PDF. So that point where the PDF flips over, that is the point where the convexity changes. So the second derivative changes of the CDF. And so that's why you got that inflection point. So when you see an inflection point in a CDF, you actually are seeing the mode of the distribution. So that's something you just learn to start looking for, inflection points in CDFs. You used to look for peaks in PDFs. Now you look for inflection points in CDFs. Okay, but so now if I invert this CDF A, if I invert that, I get B. This is my inverse CDF, which we're gonna learn is called the quantile function. And in that case, it flips the inputs and outputs. So in that case, you can think of it as taking like probability on the input and then getting an outcome on the output. All right, any more questions about that? PDFs and CDFs. Good things to be able to spot. I might put a question like that on the midterm. You know, just graphically, can you spot the PDF, the CDF, the PMF? All right, great. Okay, so rolling forward here then, we've got our background on probability. So what do we do with all of that probability? How do we build that in to something useful? And so that will be today. Then looking forward to the next unit, which is the last unit before the midterm. Once we have all those input models, how do we generate them? And so in E1, it'll be how do we generate the random numbers, the ones that are between 0 and 1, and E2, how do we take the random numbers and then turn them into random variables or random variettes? It would be the term that we use. Okay, so moving forward here, already went through this, we're building input models. We need good input models. Realistic input models help give us realistic outputs. Bad input models give us bad outputs, regardless of what our actual simulation model looks like. So these are going to be the Lego bricks that we will talk about today. These are actually, I guess, we're gonna talk about a subset of them that are kind of turned gray here. These are the Lego bricks that if you end up doing a lot of stochastic modeling in the future, these will should become second nature to you. These will just become your vocabulary. Like when someone describes a process to you, you'll say, okay, I'm gonna model that with this thing. When another stakeholder describes a different process to you, they'll say, I'm gonna model that with this thing. This is beyond our class. We're sort of giving you the kind of beginner portion of that, which is now it's hard to see on this projector, but the ones that are black here and not grayed out, those are the ones that we're focusing on. That'll be kind of your starter vocabulary for input models to do stochastic modeling. And that's what we're starting on here today. So what do I mean by that? So the simplest input model, your stakeholder comes to you and they say, you say, I would like to model this thing in simulation. What can you tell me about these values? You know, these are values that I know are random, or we have to model randomly. What's the distribution of these values? And they come back to you and they say, well, they're never lower than A and they're never bigger than B. And that's all I got. They just give you a minimum and a maximum. And so if that's the case, then you don't really have any license to do anything more than a uniform distribution. This is what we refer to as a maximum entropy distribution for those constraints. If you were to invent some other distribution that had a minimum and a maximum, but it like did other stuff in between, it had a mode and all that, you would be introducing your own bias. You would be adding information from you and not your stakeholder. This is the least biased distribution when your stakeholder comes to you and says, I have a min and a max. It just says, well, everything between the min and the max is equally likely. And so this is what its probability density function looks like. If you take the integral of it, it looks like a ramp. So If you see cumulative distribution functions that have ramps in them, those ramps represent regions of uniformity. So whenever, sometimes you'll see CDFs that will have different shapes and different pieces. If you notice a piece of them looks like a ramp, looks like this thing here, then that means that under that ramp, those values happen equally likely within that little subset. So start looking for ramps in CDFs, just like before you might have looked for level boxcars in PDFs. So that's the idea there. There are a lot of nice features of a uniform distribution that we've already kind of talked about, that the probability of an outcome happening or of an outcome happening in between any two numbers is just the CDF of the upper bound minus the CDF of the lower bound, and which, because we know the CDFs, is this formula right here. So it's really nice that the length of the interval communicates the probability of finding things inside that interval. And we use that when we do all sorts of drawing random samples or whatever. We depend upon that fact. And so we're going to talk a lot about using these in lectures that you want to need to. That's the uniform. That's kind of, we've already seen that one a little bit. Any questions about the stuff I mean there, what I mean by being the least biased way to, if somebody comes to you, says, I know in a min and a max, just use a uniform. Don't try to invent something. All right. So they might come to you and they say, all right, here's the minimum, here's the maximum. But you know what? Normally we see this value. And you say, you know, do you have anything more for you? Do you have a shape or whatever? And they say, no, that's all. I can tell you that it just seems like we usually get this value, but we know it's never less than this and never greater than this. And so under that case, the pragmatic choice is the triangular distribution, which just has a density function that looks like this. So we're going to make things more and more likely near the mode and less likely after and before it. Where they become impossible, but less than the minimum and impossible greater than the maximum. So it's just a minor sort of shift in from the uniform when you don't have a lot of information. Its CDF looks like this. And again, I'm just pointing out this inflection point in the CDF corresponds to the mode, corresponds to that most likely value. So what you want to look here is when you start looking at cumulative distribution points, look for those bends, those little knees here, these inflection points. And that shows you that you've got a local mode. And that, in the simplest case, the triangular distribution is a great example of that. All right, questions about that? These are not the most exciting of these distributions. This is when, you know, people don't come with you very much, so you have to do your best. And the triangular, it's used a lot. Because very often people come to you and they just say, that's way too low and that's way too high, but it's usually this. So just put it in as a triangular. That's, if you don't have any more data, it's a good place to start. Okay. All right, now things that are a little richer, a little more interesting. So a normal distribution. So we hear about the normal distribution a lot, largely because of the central limit theorem. It is the outcome of additive processes. So additive wear is one example. When you're building things that have multiple steps and you look at the time it takes to do the whole thing, that is another additive process. So additive processes very often are going to have normal distributions, and that's because of the central limit theorem. And we've seen examples of that back in whatever lab that was, lab three with the stochastic activity network. That was an example where the thing that was additive was more bell-shaped. And that's because the three processes were independent, so it's unlikely for their extreme events to occur at the same time. So that means that they tend to cluster around the mean and produce this, the normal distribution, otherwise known as the Gaussian distribution. So it has a two-parameter distribution. You got to know its mean, its location, and its spread, its scale. And so we often talk about mean and variance or mean and standard deviation. It's a good choice for practically unbounded variables when you only know mean and variance. This is another one of those cases where there's a mathematical property called entropy. It's a little bit outside of the scope of this class for me to define it precisely, but it is it basically minimizes the amount of information added to a distribution beyond the constraints. And if someone tells you that it's unbounded, it has a mean, and it has a variance, you can say, I can say, you can pick a bunch of unbounded distributions with a mean and a variance. You can craft a uniform distribution that has that. You can craft a triangular distribution that's that way. You can choose lots of things that meet those three constraints. But this one is the so-called maximum entropy distribution. It minimizes bias. What it says is if you choose anything other than this one, your stakeholders, or probably your boss, if you have a good boss, should come to you and say, why didn't you choose this one? In other words, why did you bias the input model toward information that only you have? What do you know that your stakeholder doesn't? And if you say, I don't know, it just felt that way, it felt like I should do it that way, then that sort of suggests that, well, probably you needed to do the normal. Now you have to be careful because it is unbounded. And so there are a lot of processes that are approximately normal because they live far away from negative numbers, for example. But technically speaking, a normal distribution can generate outcomes anywhere on the real line. And so we have this thing called a truncated normal, which is like it's a normal where you don't think that it's going to generate a lot of negative values. And so you just clip it so that even though the distribution would normally go negative, you're going to clip it and force it to drop off so that it has zero mass below zero. And that's how you sort of say, that way I get the best of both worlds. But if you choose a normal in your simulation, make sure that it has a tight enough variance that it doesn't create extreme values every once in a while that break your simulation. You know, if this is supposed to represent a time it takes to take something, like the time it takes to make a sub sandwich, because that takes multiple steps. You got bread step, you got lettuce, whatever, all of those steps add together. That, you know, may make a lot of sense to model with a normal distribution. But if you just model it blindly with a normal, occasionally, maybe once in a million times, your sim is going to say that it takes the sub negative sec or negative time to be made, because the normal can generate negative values, even if it's way far away from zero. So something to watch out for. That's the normal distribution. It's, you know, comes from additive processes or when you only know mean and variance. Any questions about that? All right, now, if a customer or a stakeholder comes to you and they say, I don't know the variance, or I know that the variance is roughly the same as the mean. But the big thing they say is, I know it's non-negative and it has an average. So I know that, for example, it's a failure time distribution. I know it takes a certain amount of time for this part to fail. And on average, it fails every 5 years. Well, you know it can't be negative. So it already, because of the failure time distribution, you know it has to be non-negative. And all they've given you is it says, on average, it fails every 5 years. All they've given you. The maximum entropy, least biased distribution, is the exponential distribution. So that's the one that, if you have no other information, just go with exponential for that. Don't do a uniform. Don't say it'll fail anytime between 0 and 5 years or 0 and 2 years or whatever. You know, don't do a triangular and make up the minimum and maximum and put the mode where they say. Just do an exponential. That way you're not adding any information beyond what has been told to you. Questions about that? So if they come to you with a mean and it's non-negative, then we choose an exponential because it's the least unbiased, or the least biased, I'm sorry, the maximally unbiased distribution, the maximal entropy distribution for those constraints. It has a lot of nice features too. And by the way, I should mention it down here. We often talk about rates and exponentials. So we'll say like, and this is often because exponentials do model the timing of events. So we often will say, well, it's an exponential with a rate of 3 students per hour. Now the exponential itself is usually modeling the outcomes are the time between arrivals. So we will say that the mean of an exponential is 1 divided by its rate. So just conventionally, we often talk about exponentials in terms of rates, but their means are actually the reciprocal of rates, their times. And there's just lots of reasons that we'll eventually get into, and you'll talk about it in 470, why it makes sense to do that. But that's just the convention we use. And then we also sometimes refer to the standard deviation as the scale of the of this. So we'll say that the it has a rate and a scale, and the standard deviation of an exponential happens to be equal to its mean. That's another interesting feature of the exponential. All right, so one of the key properties of an exponential that I want to drive home, this is another good thing to think about, like to remember for a midterm or whatever. It'll help reinforce stuff you're learning at 470. The exponential has this memoryless property. It has memorylessness. If you haven't talked about it already in 470, eventually when you get in this Kendall's notation, which I've talked about here, we said every queuing node is characterized by two letters and a number. And those two letters have to do with the input distributions for the arrivals and the services, and the number has to do with how many servers. Well, an M means exponential in Kendall's notation. The M stands for Markovian or memoryless. So it is a fundamental property. There is no other continuous distribution that has this property of having this memoryless property. What does it mean to be memoryless? Well, this is formally what it means. So the probability that the outcome is greater than the sum of two numbers, given that the outcome is greater than one of those numbers, is just equal to the probability that the outcome is greater than the other number. What we're saying there is if you know you've waited X amount of time, it doesn't give you any more information about how much longer you're going to wait. A bus, the duration between the times when buses arrive is not exponential. Because if you go to a bus stop, you can ask somebody who's standing there how long you've been waiting. And they'll say, well, I've been waiting about 10 minutes. And you know the bus arrives every 15, so you know probably it's arriving in the next 5. That means that the system has memory. If buses arrived according to exponential distributions, there would be no value asking someone who's waiting how long they've been waiting, because the probability of continually waiting, it's the same. That's the interesting fractal feature of the exponential, is that even if someone's been waiting for 100 years, there's an equal probability that now that you've arrived that you'll continue to wait for 100 years. It doesn't help you to know that you've already waited for 100 years. That's this weird property of being an exponential. So forest fires might be described with exponential waiting times, but bus inter-arrival times are not. So you have to know the system. And if the system does not appear to have this property, then you probably need more information to choose a non-exponential. Any questions about that? A lot of systems actually don't have this property, but they approximate this property. And so we're okay with using an exponential. Okay, now we can build from that. So I mentioned failure times. I could say that there is a failure time. Let's say that behind there was a supply closet in here through there. So there's a supply closet in there. Let's say they have a bunch of light bulbs for an overhead projector or one of these lights here. I could model the failure time of one of these light bulbs as an exponential, and the failure time of all of the spare light bulbs as exponentials. Well, now I need to model how long until I need to resupply that closet with new light bulbs. Well, there are three light bulbs in the closet. There's one here. This one is an exponential, plus those three exponentials in sequence. So really I want to know is how long will four independent exponentials take? And that is what the Erlang distribution is, or otherwise known as the gamma distribution. So the Erlang K distribution, in that case, this would be the Erlang 4 distribution. That is how long does it take this for four exponentials to wait on four independent exponentials that are otherwise equivalent. So it's the sum of that up there. So let's see how many people are paying attention. So what is another name for an Erlang 1 distribution? An exponential, thank you. So, and if I look at these PDFs here, so I've got a bunch of sample PDFs. There's two examples here where K is equal to one. So this one, it's kind of red, and this one's kind of purple. The red one's easier to see. And you can see its PDF looks like an exponential because it is. An Erlang will degenerate into an exponential when K is equal to one. As K gets greater than one, then it gets more hump-shaped. Why does that make sense? That as K gets larger, the Erlang distribution starts looking less like an exponential and more like a pimple, more like a hump-shaped object. What do we know about the Erlang distribution, and what maybe suggests that that's the right direction, that that's what we would expect? As K gets larger, this will get more hump-shaped and symmetric. Central limit theorem, absolutely. This is another example of the central limit theorem. You're summing up independent variables that are otherwise equivalent. An Erlang infinity is a normal distribution. So if you take K to infinity, this PDF will go to the normal. So K equal to one, this PDF is exponential. K equal infinity, this PDF is normal. So it's just a special case where if you know that you're adding up parts that are exponential, the Erlang is a better choice than a normal because it's a better approximation. But eventually, as you add up enough of them, it all becomes normal anyway. Questions about that? The Erlang. It's our addition of exponentials. Great. So that's one, that was that one problem of like, I got one bulb and three bulbs in the closet. How long till I have to reorder bulbs for the closet? Now, another problem would be, so the bulb that I've got out of the factory, it eventually behaves like an exponential. Like if it manages to survive long enough, it will behave with an exponential failure distribution. But so a bunch of these bulbs fail right after the factory. And so we have to use a burn-in period to find out where those bulbs are and get rid of them. So that means we need something that's partially exponential, but we kind of want to pull it down at the beginning. We want to sort of play with it a little bit. And you can kind of do that with an Erlang because you can see, as you know, for like K equals two, it does that. It like sort of says that, you know, these things, well, maybe that would be that, you know, it never fails out of the factory. Whereas an exponential, well, some would fail out of the factory, but you can play with what happens here a little bit with the Erlang, but it's not very flexible. So that's where we get the Weibull distribution. So you take a reliability course, quality courses, then you're going to see Weibull distributions. Weibull distribution is a modification of an exponential. So it looks very much like an exponential, but they add another parameter. So they have a K parameter that is like the Erlang adds a K, but it's just a general, we're going to call a shape parameter. And it allows you to start with an exponential and then bend it one way or another to help better fit your data. And so you can, these are all different Weibull distributions with different shape parameters. And so if you can't read this, I've got K values here from 0.5 all the way up to 5. And you can see that when K is equal to one, it is an exponential. It degenerates into an exponential, but I can bend it down so that things never happen at zero, or I can bend it up so that things happen primarily at zero. I can shift things so that things cluster at points way out here. So it gives me a lot more flexibility. So if you've got something that's approximately exponential, but it doesn't quite fit, then this gives you one more parameter to help bend it into fitting. And so the failure people really like it because failures are usually approximately exponential. At some point in their lifetime, they're going to behave like an exponential, but they won't behave like an exponential in all of their lifetime. So that shape parameter allows you to bend them in just a little bit to make it a little more realistic. That's the Weibull distribution. Questions on that? Great. Okay. All right, now we're going to flip into the discretes. So remember, these ones down here, these are kind of your starter set, your starter kit of models that you can start building input models with. And so we've just talked about all of the continuous ones that I want you to know in this class, and now the discrete ones. And the first one is the Poisson distribution. This is related, but it's not the same thing as a Poisson process. How many people have heard about a Poisson process in their other courses? Any of them, like 470? Not yet. You will. You'll be hit over the head with a Poisson process. Poisson process uses a Poisson random variable or Poisson, yeah, distribution, but they're not the same thing. Poisson is discrete. Students will confuse the Poisson with the exponential because they are closely related. But exponential is continuous, Poisson is discrete. A Poisson random variable describes the count of events that are exponentially spaced in an interval. So if I were to ask, how many students arrive to class in a particular set of 5 minutes before class, if I assume that they're exponentially spaced, that count will be Poisson distributed. So it's a count, so it's discrete. So the spacing there is exponential, so that's continuous. But the number that actually happened in the interval I've selected, it's a discrete number. It's got to be a count. And that count could be zero, could be one, could be 10. And that count is described by a Poisson. And so that's what we see here. It has this parameter alpha, which you can kind of think here as the average count. So like if I have an alpha of equal to four, so that's this purple one, then I get this kind of hump-shaped thing. And that's saying that this is a count of events where you could get zero events, you could do 15 events, but normally you get roughly four events. And that's what an alpha of four means here. How you go from an exponential to a Poisson is you take the exponential rate, remember I said it was rate, and you multiply it by the interval. So if I know that at the airport, that people arrive to the airport and they're exponentially spaced, but that exponential spacing means that two people arrive at the airport per hour. And so I want to know how many people will arrive for 10 hours. Well, then I multiply the two by the 10, and it will be a Poisson random variable with a mean of 20. That's 2 times 10. So that's how those two things relate. The Poisson describes the count of exponentially spaced things. Questions about that? And so you can get these shapes. And for reasons that relate to the central limit theorem that I won't go into here, it does get more and more bell-shaped. A Poisson distribution will eventually look like a normal distribution for high values of alpha, for high means. But it's discrete, not continuous. Okay, so that's our Poisson distribution. The interesting thing about a Poisson distribution, the mean and variance are the same. So I mentioned with an exponential, the mean and standard deviation are the same. Poisson is one of the few ones where the mean and variance are the same. So it's kind of an interesting feature. All right, now I would call Poisson as part of the exponential family of variables. These last four, or these last three, are in the Bernoulli family. So it's a different way, a different set of discrete random variables here. So we first have to talk about a Bernoulli distribution or a Bernoulli trial. This is just a weighted coin toss. Does it come up heads or tails? And we don't assume that it's a fair coin. So it could come up heads more often than tails, tails more often than heads. So that probability is the key feature of your Bernoulli trial. So this probability for heads, 1 minus that probability for tails. That's what we mean by a Bernoulli trial. And we build these other distributions off of it. So once we have this trial, this is just the probability of a single outcome of a coin toss. Then from there, we can build a binomial distribution. A binomial distribution is you has two parameters, the number of coin tosses and the probability each coin comes up heads. So with those two parameters, then it's going to describe for us the number of successes we're going to get in those coin tosses. So the idea here is that, like, if my probability is 0.5, like in this blue example, and my number of coin tosses is 20, so here's 20. You can see this blue one, I'm trying to trace it out here. It peaks at 10 and it doesn't go any higher than 20. I can't have an outcome greater than 20 because I only have 20 tosses. If it's a fair coin, then the average value is that of 10 come up heads and 10 come up tails. But coins aren't that, or they're very variable. So even though that's the average, then there are still significant times when 5 come up heads and 15 come up tails, or the other flip side, so to speak, 15 come up heads and 5 come up tails. So that's what we're describing here. The green one here, we've now got a 70% chance with 20 tosses of coming up heads. And you can see that it shifts it so that it goes toward 20. So it's more often that they're going to get come up heads. So that's our binomial distribution, the number of successes in a fixed number of trials. Now, the other half of that, any questions about that? The other half of that is how many trials do I need to get my first success or my first failure? And so that's the negative binomial. And so negative binomial, it's parametrized by how many successes you're looking for and what's the probability of success. But it can be infinite. So its range is potentially infinite. So this is saying I've got my coin that is fair, unfair, whatever, P, and I'm looking for 5 successes. So how often do I have to flip this thing to eventually get my fifth heads? That's what the negative binomial gives you. So the number of independent trials until the rth success. In the special case of one, where you're just looking for the first success or the first failure, then this is the so-called geometric distribution. And this is basically the analog to the exponential distribution. So this is like the exponential distribution is how long until my failure. This is just like that, but it's how many flips until the first failure. How many days do you come into work before the copier breaks down? That is the geometric distribution. How many days, not how much time. And it happens to have the memoryless property as well, but it's discrete. All right, any questions about that? Binomial versus negative binomial. Okay. And then I'll remind us of this last time. The last thing I want to show you today is that a random process is an index family of random variables. And so I'll remind us of that when we start next time, but this is big 470 stuff. But it's the idea here that if you have a Poisson process is something which is the count of events up to a particular time for all times. So each one of these things is a Poisson random variable, but it's for all possible times. We collect them together and that becomes a Poisson process. All right, let me get to a final clicker here. And right, this is all spare slides there. All right, so let me do a final clicker and then you guys can get out of here. All right, so clicker should be running. So short answer, question being, which distribution is the best to choose if someone says they have a non-negative random variable with a known mean? So that's all they tell you. They give you the mean and they tell you it can't have any negative numbers. So a non-negative random variable, like a failure time distribution with a given mean. If that's all you know, what input model should you pick? And that's all I've got for you. So then we can see you Thursday.